Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for April 21st, 2008, and on this episode we have an interview with artistic director Julianne Eyre from Greasy Joan. She'll be talking to Tom Williams about, well, let's just call it the Scottish play. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, Chicago, and let's talk theater.
Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Our guest this week is Julianne Eyre, who is the artistic director and the current director of Greasy Joan's terrific new production of the Scottish play, Macbeth. Hello, Julianne.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, we appreciate you coming on. Tell us why and all about what made you decide to do Macbeth.
Sure. Our focus at Greasy Joan is classic plays. And we often look to do them in contemporary ways or with contemporary adaptations. But last year, when we were season planning, we were talking about kind of a back-to-the-basics classics approach for this season. So we just did two back-to-back productions, the first one of The Misanthrope, and then the second one, we hadn't done Shakespeare in a long time, and so we decided to do a Shakespeare play. And I personally gravitated towards Macbeth. I just really love the play in terms of the supernatural aspect of it. I've done a lot of Jose Rivera plays and am interested in Latin American literature that kind of focuses on magical realism and creating other worlds on stage is something that really interests me. And I just thought Macbeth was a great opportunity for us to deal with witches and ghosts and, as Macbeth himself puts it, strange imaginings, and it would just be a really fun play to work on. So that was the first impetus. And then the second one being, we also look to do plays that just feel really right for contemporary times, and this play politically just felt like the right time to be doing this play about, you know, a leader who becomes hungry for power and through his own ambition kind of drives his country into the ground, and the country is forced to really look at itself and figure out how they need to remake themselves and what their future needs to be. And that felt like an appropriate story to be telling at this time.
Yeah, there's a kind of an obvious parallel there.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that storefront theater or non-equity theater suffers from that you guys never do. One is sets. You guys do create terrific sets.
Oh, thank you.
And this Macbeth, not only the set design, sound design, lighting, and the costumes just added a dimension that was thrilling.
Oh, good. That's another focus and interest of ours is having a really strong visual metaphor for our productions. And we've been extremely lucky in that we really get top-notch designers to come and design for us, given that we're a smaller company in Chicago. And part of that is that we do focus on design, and we do work that's more poetic and metaphorical. And so designers who are working at larger theaters like the Goodman or Northlight or Writers Theater, they come back to Greasy Joan knowing that they're going to have a really good experience in terms of the design of the play. So we're very proud of that.
Yeah, and I like the way you did a contemporary uniforms and clothing on most of the people, except what you, I like what you did with the witches.
Oh, good.
See if you can explain that a little bit to interest some of our listeners to come out to the Athenaeum
to
see your production.
I think when you're tackling a play like Macbeth or you're tackling a Greek play, one of the things that you really need to solve early on is who the witches are going to be in Macbeth, or with a play like Antigone, which we did, or the Oresteia. You know, you have to figure out how you're going to deal with the chorus, and that's kind of a central, I would just say, problem to these plays in that how they translate to a contemporary audience can be challenging.
Yeah, they can either
lay a big bomb the way you do it, or make it artistically brilliant.
Exactly.
Which is the way you guys have done it. I saw all the plays you talked about, and you really find a unique way of doing the choruses.
Oh, good, good. Yeah, I think that they're really central to telling the stories, but especially with the Greek plays, these plays were done so long ago that it's harder for a contemporary audience to hear all that, expository speaking. And so with the witches, it was kind of funny because I really tried to do something at first. I wanted them to be very realistic. I was trying to move away from stuff I'd done in the past. And ultimately, I was thinking of the witches as being very real people that kind of emerge out of this society that we are creating, and ultimately I ended up going in a different direction with them and making them more supernatural. And one thing that we talked about with the witches was making them have a real purpose for being there, so they didn't just feel that they didn't belong in the world. Like, why are there witches? What is it that they want from Macbeth? What's their purpose there? And so we decided that the witches were like spirits the play starts with Duncan, and Macbeth, kills Duncan and takes over. And we had decided that Duncan himself was kind of like a Vladimir Putin-type leader, that he himself had squelched democracy in this country, and he was not a favorable leader and had already kind of set the course for which Macbeth continues on. And so so the world that we were creating from the start was one of paranoia and terror, where there wasn't a free media and there weren't free elections, and people were being arrested for political beliefs. And that was the world of Duncan. And so we felt that the witches were people who had suffered under Duncan's reign and who had actually been killed and were sort of inhabiting the spirits of people who had suffered under Duncan, and so that they used Macbeth in a way to try to set the country on the right course.
Yeah.
That they weren't evil beings, but they were not using the most peaceful means to get what they wanted. So that's kind of where the witches started. And then the other aspect to them is, we looked kind of at nature goddesses and them coming from a very natural world, as opposed to the other side of the design, which is, very cold and metallic, and this very kind of technological world of the people versus the witches, who were more connected to nature and trying to connect more with natural elements and get the people involved in the world of the play back in the right course.
Well, I thought what you did particularly with the sound design, the to creating that atmosphere, that eerie atmosphere that you needed at certain points, was very effective.
Oh, good. I agree. I think the sound design is outstanding, and the credit really goes to Andrew Hansen. He is one of my favorite collaborators, and his sound design is really extraordinary. Because the set is so metaphorical, we really needed strong sound and lights, and the lighting designer, Charlie Cooper, is enormously talented as well. We really depended on both of them to help create the environment of the play, and certainly Andy's sound. We talked about the witches and that environment feeling kind of magical and supernatural, and versus the world of the men in the play, which is more kind of cold and machine-like, and so that first sound cue that starts us off in the play is that big machine kind of starting up, and you hear it running as a theme throughout the play, and it really makes it very exciting.
I also like the way you pace the show.
Oh, good.
Because I've seen Shakespeare's where they sit and everybody poses over every line, and it's
yeah.
Just, after a while, you just tune it out. This thing really moves. I know it is one of Shakespeare's shorter plays, but it just keeps popping and just keeps moving.
It's one of his more kind of action-packed plays,
yeah,
for
that's...
sure. There's not a lot of speechifying. There's a lot of action in the play, And so, you know, in a way you have to kind of fight against it because you don't want it to move so fast, the story isn't clear. But I think Dana Wall, who's playing Macbeth, one of his extraordinary talents is that he's very good with language and he makes the story really clear. I had audience members who were there on opening night who commented on that specifically, that they hadn't read the play in a long time and they could completely follow the story.
Yeah, how did you find Dana? He's a major talent.
Oh, good.
Because, you know, my pet peeve of Shakespeare, and it, particularly in, you know, on actors who aren't classically trained, is they mumble or they race through the lines and you just tune it out after a while because
yeah.
It's just like a run-on words.
Exactly. It's so important with Shakespeare to make the language really clear, and I think that's one thing they do very successfully at Chicago Shakes. You know, when I go
Absolutely.
There, I can really understand the story. And that doesn't mean you have to understand every single line. I mean, we've been in rehearsals for 7 weeks, you know, tearing apart some of this language and trying to really understand it and looking up words and books and, you know, but ultimately you make acting choices that even if the language isn't 100% clear at times to the audience, they can understand what's happening by the behavior on stage.
Well, Dana really, really does a terrific job.
Oh, yeah, he really does.
And how he digs deep into the psychological and emotional changes that happened to Macbeth.
I mean, right.
You guys hit on the psychology of it. You see how paranoid and him and Lady Macbeth become.
Right. Yeah, and one thing Dana and I had talked about, again, kind of connecting this to contemporary times, we'd been reading articles about post-traumatic stress syndrome in soldiers coming back from Iraq, and sadly, certain percentages of them that have committed murders since they've come back because they're so stressed out from having been in this war zone and there hasn't been kind of appropriate treatment for them upon their return. So we're looking at that in terms of Macbeth, that he is a soldier, he's a warrior, he's someone who's killed in battle, and when he comes home, he's not quite able to drop the trauma of war. And so I think that plays into after he kills Duncan and his response to that. This is a man who has killed before, but killing someone that he knows personally is, you know, really sets him off on a different course. And so kind of tracing that paranoia throughout, one thing that influenced us was just thinking about how difficult it must be to come back from war and be trained to be a warrior and then try to acclimate back into society.
Yeah, that's an age-old problem. I particularly like your casting of Lady Macbeth. Tell us about this young lady. I've not seen her before, but boy, is she terrific.
Oh, good. Yeah, Sherina Martin is a new graduate, or recent graduate of Northwestern University.
Well, you Northwestern folks are all over the place.
You know? That is true. That is true. Just having a great university here with a strong theater program, you know, a lot of those graduates stay. And, you know, we didn't have a Lady Macbeth in mind, and we auditioned a lot of people, and Sherina just made such strong choices in auditions that we cast her.
So that she was literally just came on a casting call.
That's right.
That's
yeah,
true.
We just had, we ask for submissions of headshots, and then we go through resumes looking for people who have had, because we do classic work and we're a non-equity company, you know, we really have challenges in terms of casting. A lot of people that are more classically trained have gone on to equity cards and working at larger theaters, and so we do end up with a lot of young actors who are out of these strong training programs who, you know, haven't quite made it yet to the Goodman. A lot of our actors do end up, you know, going equity and we miss them. But Sherina is still pretty young and is someone that we're excited about introducing to the Chicago community.
Well, she really nailed Lady Macbeth.
Good.
I mean,
good.
It was, she had the power and you could believe that her and Dana Wall were going through all this trauma.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a great casting choice. But I like some of the other people in the show, too, quite a bit. Kevin Cox is terrific.
He is terrific. He was just the lead Alceste in our production of The Misanthrope.
Which, by the way, was terrific. I very much enjoyed that.
Thank you. I agree. Yes, Kevin is enormously talented, and we felt privileged to have him in two of our productions this season. He plays Macduff and also plays one of the murderers and does a fantastic job with both. He just has a real sense for language and is a very professional, committed, hardworking actor. So it's been a pleasure to work with him as well.
And he's got a big voice, too. He could have a big voiceover career.
He definitely could, yes. He does have a big voice, and it has a lot of range to it as well.
And tell us about the young man playing Malcolm. I thought he did a nice job.
Nick Mikula is also a younger actor with classic training from, I believe Nick is out of Northern Illinois University.
Illinois State. I'm looking at the program.
Illinois State.
See,
thank
you.
See,
that's how smart I am. I have the program.
A lot of actors are hard to keep all their bios in my mind.
Oh, yeah.
Nick is terrific, and he brings a wonderful energy to Malcolm. And also what's important is kind of a youthful zest to that character. Malcolm is Duncan's son and ultimately ends up taking over as leader. And one thing we talked about was that at the beginning of the play, Malcolm is kind of this hapless young man, a teenager really, who isn't capable of leading the country. And so we see his journey throughout the play, that by the end, he's someone that can really bring hope and confidence to this country after.
Yeah, a lot of people don't play it that way, and all of a sudden you go, him? At the end, yeah. I like the way you developed that. It really made sense.
Yeah.
Well, let's put a little commercial out for the show. You are at the Athenaeum Theater.
We are.
What days do you run?
We run Thursdays through Saturdays at 8 o'clock and Sundays at 3 o'clock through May 25th.
Through May 25th. I'll tell you, I used to tell people, be careful of going to Shakespeare if it isn't Chicago Shakespeare, because I've seen the Bard's work been butchered in some of the non-equity productions, but you guys are on a level right with the equity houses.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom. We're really excited and proud about this production and looking forward to having audiences come enjoy our work. It's a really great play, and and it isn't done very often.
It's a very
challenging play. It's on Broadway right now with Patrick Stewart, but in Chicago there haven't been a lot of productions of it recently, so this is a great opportunity for people to come check it out.
Well, let's talk about Greasy Jones' background.
Sure.
I have seen a number of phenomenal plays that you guys have done, particularly like some of the Greek tragedies that, again, were the kind of things that could really put you to sleep. And boy, when you go see your product, you come out and you go, wow, that was really great. And it was entertaining and it kept moving. And I wish all Greek tragedies were looked that good. So tell us about how Greasy Jones started and, first of all, how you got the name.
Sure, of course. That's what everyone asks. Greasy Jones was founded 12 years ago. And the founding members, a lot of them came out of the ART program in Boston. And from various, not just classically trained actors, but, actors who were just excited and interested in having kind of a mid-level company in Chicago that was devoted to classic plays. And so all of those people have actually moved on, except one of them who's still on our board. But originally their intent was to have a classic-based company in Chicago. And they chose the name Greasy Jones from a Shakespeare play, Love's Labor's Lost. Greasy Jones doth keel the pot is a line at the end, meaning she's stirring things up. So their intention was to stir things up with classic plays here.
Well, you have by making them entertaining.
Good, good. And then I came on in 2003. I directed Marisol by Jose Rivera for the company. And the company was just in this transition phase where, again, a lot of the founding members had left, and they needed to decide, kind of how to move the company forward. And it had been an ensemble-based organization, but because so many of those people had gone, it couldn't really last that way. And so the board made the decision to bring on someone who could kind of lead the company. And I knew a lot of the founding members. I had just graduated from Northwestern University's MFA directing program. And I was also just really interested in classic work. So it was a really good fit, a really good time. And And I came on, and one thing that I've tried to focus on, as we've already talked about, is how to really connect these classic plays to a contemporary audience. And so one thing we've done is we've looked for kind of new translations or new adaptations of classics. For example, last year we did Jose Rivera's version of a 17th century Spanish play, Life's a Dream, retitled it Sueño.
Mm-hmm.
But also when we do a play that isn't a contemporary adaptation, you know, we look for plays that are telling a story that really connects to what's happening in the world. We have a very strong design element and look to create design that audiences can really relate to, that can, you know, it creates kind of a contemporary metaphor for these plays. So that's kind of the
And you guys do it on
history.
You do it on a modest budget too, I would imagine.
That it's very modest. So if we have any listeners out there that feel like contributing,
absolutely,
it's always welcome.
Go to the Greasy Joan and Company website and
exactly greasyjoan.org.
Well, hopefully with the national election coming up, we'll be able to put the right people in, and the grants to the arts will increase.
That sounds good.
Yeah,
that sounds
I'm sure
good.
You wouldn't argue with that. But you guys also prove that you don't have to have the big budgets if you're creative to create good sound and lighting and sets.
You know, it's funny, you do hear that from various artists around the world. Like, there's a certain, I don't know, when you're under a certain economic or even political pressure to create something, it sort of pushes you to be more, I don't know, adventurous or more kind of, I don't know, bolder maybe with your choices because you have less to lose perhaps. You know, and once people are handed these kind of huge budgets, it perhaps becomes overwhelming. But, yeah, you know, it's hard to be a smaller company where you don't always have the dollars. We don't have the kind of development and marketing aspects that a larger company has. And so it is always challenging, but somehow we manage to bring on really talented people and make it all come together. And
well, a lot of it comes from your leadership.
Well, thank you.
I got to ask you, I see in your credits that you served as assistant director on Metamorphosis with Mary Zimmerman. That had to be a fabulous experience.
It really was. And that was when it moved from second stage in New York to Broadway. I studied with Mary at Northwestern. And my third year, she brought me on to go to New York with her. And I was able to be in previews when she wasn't able to be there and just kind of see that show remounted on Broadway. So that was exciting. That was my big White Way experience.
How was Mary to work with? Everyone tells me she's a doll to work with.
No, Mary's really great. She's really bright and funny and just a very personable person to be around. I really enjoyed studying with her in school and have a continued relationship with her. And yeah, it was a great experience.
Does she come see your, when she's in town, does she come see your work?
As she's able to, yeah.
All right, let me ask you, of the plays that you've directed in the past few years, tell us some of the ones you're the proudest of or your favorites, if that's not too unfair a question.
You know, it's funny, I feel so connected to projects that I'm currently working on, and you know, I don't know that I have particular favorites. I can look back and kind
or
of
ones that you're proud of.
Sure.
That when you look back, you say, you know, that really worked.
Yeah, I mean, Antigone was definitely a huge success. And one thing I do is I look for plays that I'm not really sure I can handle. You know,
you want the challenge, huh?
Yeah, I like a challenge. It's kind of like theatrical bungee jumping, I guess. Taking on a big Greek play is, you know, something that isn't often done, and it's very challenging to figure out how to make these ancient plays work, and I think Antigone worked so well, and
yeah,
it really connected to audiences. It was, you know, right at the start of, was it at the start? I guess it was, you know, as the Iraq War was going on, it was right in the election with John Kerry and George Bush, and it just touched on a lot of political issues that people are really fired up about, and again, the chorus is something that's really hard, and I think that really worked.
Yes, it did. I like the lady from the Sea that you did,
yeah,
too.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, and that was another Ibsen play, and that had a very strong cast to it. And, you know, so much about theater is really based on who you're working with. It's a very collaborative art form. And Lady from the Sea had a really terrific cast and also a terrific design team. One of my favorite productions, though, that was greatly overlooked was The Nose, which was an adaptation of short stories by Nikolai Gogol. And Andy Hansen, who's doing the sound for him for Macbeth, we collaborated on that and talked about creating a musical without any singing. And so Andy composed original music for that production.
I did not see that, but I heard good things about
it.
I know.
Yeah.
I try and see, you know, I do 300 a year, so somehow I can't get them all in.
Yeah, that was a really innovative production. And the costumes by Anna Kuzmanek, whose work is now on Broadway with August Osage County, we just had an extraordinary group of people. Guy Massey was the lead in that, who's a popular actor in Chicago who's in The Strangerer now with Theodore Ublick. We had a ton of fun with that show and just the absurdism of Gogol and that period in Russia, making fun of Russian bureaucracy.
Well, I hope you remount that.
We should. It was a lot of fun. So that's another thing that I'm proud of because it was a more adventurous production and really just the music, especially for it, was really terrific.
How are your shows doing? Are you getting the audiences?
We are getting the audiences. Misanthrope was selling out, and we wished we could extend it, but luckily we were invited to be on Theater on the Lake.
Oh, great.
So Misanthrope will be, I think, I don't have the dates in front of me. It's mid-June, I believe.
Yeah, it's mid-June, yeah.
June 11th on Theater on the Lake, so it'll have a second installment. We don't have our own space, so it's always challenging when a show takes off. You know, you want to extend it, but we were right up with producing Macbeth and weren't able to. So.
Well, I think as the word gets out with Macbeth, you're going to do well with that, too.
We look forward to that. Thank you.
Well, because when, you know, I all my theater friends, when they see, oh, who's doing Macbeth, and they look, if it's somebody they don't know, if it's not Chicago Shakespeare, they look up reviews and they look up what people are saying, and the buzz has been strong on your show.
Definitely. It's a really great production, and I'm excited for it to take off.
Okay, tell us some of the goals that you have for yourself and for Greasy Joan over the next, say, 4 or 5 years. Where would you like to be?
Sure. I think a lot of the past couple of years, you know, it's just been kind of playing catch-up a little bit with Greasy Joan, and in that a lot of people, when I came on, had just left, and so we're just trying to stabilize operations. And in the past couple of years, we've had really terrific people come on board, and so that's enabled us to kind of focus more on art. It allowed me, at least, to focus more on artistic matters, as we've had people who are more focused on kind of the fundraising and whatnot. So, you know, I think our goals in the next couple of years is just to continue to not only stabilize operations, but to really have the company get to the next level where we have more paid staff and you know, can really kind of raise more funding so that we're not totally reliant on volunteers. The problem when you're this size is that you have volunteers and they have day jobs, and it's hard for people to find the time to, you know, get things done. And so I'm enormously proud of the work that we've done. We have terrific company members who devote so much behind-the-scene times to the work. But the next level for us is to really have someone who can focus on development efforts and have a larger board of directors and paid staff so that, you know, we're not always just kind of shooting from the hip.
Well, I can see that. What shows are on your horizon, or if you could wave a magic wand, what are some of the shows you'd like to do that you haven't done?
You know, we actually, we tried to get the rights to Eurydice, and unfortunately Victory Gardens beat us out, Eurydice by Sarah Rule. And so we're still planning for next season. We haven't solidified those choices yet. We hope to in the next month. We haven't done Chekhov in a long time, if ever. I don't think the company's ever done Chekhov, and that's one writer who really appeals to us. We have a really exciting project lined up for the late summer in August. We are starting something called the Contemporary Classics Series. So we've commissioned three playwrights who are all going to be writing original adaptations of classic plays. and there'll be a reading of that in the summer. And this is something that's really exciting for us because we haven't ever done anything like this. And while there's a lot of new work out there, we're not aware, especially in Chicago, but not really aware of any kind of series that really focuses on contemporary playwrights adapting classic work for the stage.
It's a great idea, and there's a need for that.
You know, it perfectly fits our mission, and it's a great niche for us, given, you know, our interest in kind of bridging the classic and the contemporary. We really have enjoyed our relationship with Jose Rivera and are looking to expand that to younger writers, or, you know, more emerging writers.
Can young writers, if they're interested in getting involved in this, can they contact you?
You know, we've already chosen 3 authors. We hope to continue to do this, and there'll be information on our website.
Okay.
You know, we'll probably have another submission to do it again in the fall. But, yeah, we started really early with this and had over 50 submissions and whittled it down to 3 playwrights. And we'll be doing this in August. So
terrific.
That's really exciting.
Well, I know one other thing you're looking forward to is soon you're going to be having a child.
I am, yes. I said there should be a special award for someone who directs Macbeth while they're 8 months pregnant. So, yeah. I have a daughter at home, Esther, and we are expecting a second child. So that's my next opening in May.
Your next opening in May. Well, I'm sure that will work out. And thank you so much. This has been fun, and you are a great example of what small storefront theater, non-equity theater, the quality. You guys are the bedrock of Chicago theater.
Oh, well, we're very proud of the work that we do, and we appreciate your support. Thanks so much, Tom.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of April 21st, 2008. Chicago Shakespeare Theater concludes its 21st season with The Comedy of Errors. Set in the 1940s during the Golden Age of Film, Shakespeare's comedic classic unfolds as an eccentric group of actors gather on an English movie set to film the play. This time it's set during World War II in the midst of the London Blitz. The Comedy of Errors begins previews on Sunday, April 27th. The show will be running through June 29th. Chicago Shakes artistic director Barbara Gaines stages the Comedy of Errors for the first time in her career. She is collaborating with Second City veteran Ron West, who brings an additional comedic twist to the production. Barbara Gaines, who is also the founder of CST, has directed more than 30 of William Shakespeare's plays throughout her career. She's also been honored with several Jeff Awards for Best Production and Best Director. Tickets can be purchased by visiting chicagoshakes.com, or to see if you can find a deal, click on over to our website, theaterinchicago.com. His Honor has found a new home at the new Frank Sinatra Performing Arts Center on Taylor Street. The open-ended run of His Honor begins on Sunday, May 18th, in the upstairs room of the National Italian-American Sports Hall of Fame. This is a temporary space until the Frank Sinatra Performing Arts Center opens up later this year. His Honor is written by and starring Neil Giantoli. It is a look at the man atop of Chicago's political machine and who was a major influence on national policy and politics, Richard J. Daley. His Honor first opened on March 2, 2006 at the Prop Theater to critical acclaim. After more than 300 performances, they now get a brand new state-of-the-art theater. Tickets are currently on sale and may be purchased at hishonortheplay.com, and remember, that's with 2 Z's, or to check out an interview with Neil Giantoli right before the show opened 2 years ago back in 2006. Be sure to check out the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast archives. The Kid from Brooklyn, the Danny Kaye musical, is a new musical based on the life of entertainment legend Danny Kaye. The Kid from Brooklyn is coming to the Mercury Theater for a limited engagement starting on June 7th. This opening follows a sellout run at LA's El Portal Theater, where the show was extended twice due to popular demand. It is based on the turbulent and triumphant life of Danny Kaye, who you may remember from films such as Up in Arms, The Inspector General, and White Christmas. He received a Special Academy Award in 1954, and he also won an Emmy Award in 1963 for his famous TV show, The Danny Kaye Show. Tickets for The Kid from Brooklyn, the Danny Kaye musical, are available online at thekidfrombrooklynmusical.com. Or for all of this information and more, check out Talk Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago. And I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Julianne Eyre for giving us the honor of interviewing her this week. I would also like to thank Tom Williams and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.